Chamber of Commerce Committee to order. We have in attendance Representative Bruckman, Representative Harnell, Representative Donnelly, Representative Finkelstein, Representative Ivan, who was just here. And put that in the room. We have or had Representative Brown with us as well, and we had previously heard House Bill 121. If we can get Representative Ivan and Representative Brown in the room, we may want to take that up first. After that, we have the confirmation hearing for Peter Sokoloff, and then we're going to try to get to House Bill 240, House Bill 194, and House Bill 162. If we don't get to any of those last three bills, we will schedule them again immediately. We may even try to set up a subcommittee or something so that we can continue work and not delay their progress. We've been joined by Representative Zwack as well. Representative Brown, can you join? We'll try to do this as quickly as we can because we don't want to delay the confirmation hearing. Where we left off last time, at our last hearing, this is you to explain the bill to us, but we hadn't had a chance for any of the committee members to ask any questions. We had public testimony on it as well. Is there anything you want to add just in general before we take any other comments?
No, Mr. Chairman.
We've got in Anchorage Commissioner Foster on the teleconference. Commissioner Foster, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
If you'd, I know you came to the last hearing as well. If you could just offer any additional thoughts you wanted this time, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I simply stand ready to answer questions and reiterate the commission's support for HB 121.
Great. Well, I appreciate your coming again to this hearing. Is there anyone else we have on teleconference who want to testify on House Bill 121? Is there anyone in attendance today who wants to testify on House Bill 121? Well, so much for the public hearing. Is there any questions any committee members would like to ask? This we had this up at our last energy-related meeting as well. I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, so I don't have any questions. Is there a motion on the thing, Representative Donnelly?
Move the bill with individual recommendations.
Is there objection to moving the bill with individual recommendations? Hearing no objection, so moved. I do note for the record that we have Tom Waldo signed up to testify. I guess he didn't want to testify, so. Always happy to have less testimony. Thank you, Representative. The next thing before us is the confirmation hearing. Mr. Sokoloff could join us. There really isn't any requirement for you to give any presentation of any sort. You're welcome, though, to tell us some about your experience on the commission if you feel inclined.
Well, just to give you a background. I joined the commission as an engineer back in 1976. In 79, I became chief engineer on the staff of the commission, and I was appointed to the commission in by Governor Cooper in 1987 to fill the remaining term of Commissioner Weatherly, which is the engineering seat. And then on this December 1st, 1989, I was appointed by Governor Cooper as chairman of the commission. And then I held that position until January of this year when Governor Hickel shifted seats and appointed Don Schroer to the commissioner seat, and Commissioner Foster, who just was in teleconference, he then was moved to the engineering seat because he has an engineering background.
Great. The main purpose of this hearing is talk about the qualifications for these particular positions on the commission. This appointment also has a referral to the Judiciary Committee, which is intended to give legislature a chance to express its views on the constitutionality and the proper roles of the the legislature and the executive in appointments like this. So we'll open up the floor to any questions people have on any of the issues relating to the substance of the commission's role. Any questions? I have a few myself. Representative Parnell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your operation as a designated engineer in that particular seat, does the qualification bring with it sort of a burden on behalf of the commission itself that requires you to do more research, and do they rely more on the engineer perspective as you operate in that particular seat?
Oh, certainly in when we have adjudicatory meetings and the engineering subjects come up, you know, I explain, you know, my position and why it's so. And some of the issues that come before the commission become quite technical. My background, as you see, is almost entirely in telephone. And during this last year, when we discussed this telephone competition, I think there were numerous engineering issues that came up where I offered my opinion, and the commission, in most cases, the other commissioners, you know, agreed with them. But we are structured in a way that there's a legal seat, a business seat, an engineering seat, and then.
When the governor first proposed your name for the first term and submitted you to the legislature, then you went through the same process with the same credentials for the same seat. Did you feel that maybe it's, and you don't need to respond if you don't care to, but did you feel that the way of shifting another member over without submitting the credentials to the member, of the member to this body for approval, didn't quite meet the same criteria that you had to meet when you were submitted? In other words, the changing of that person from a consumer seat over to the engineering seat without going back through the same process that you had to go through. Do you have any observations on that or any thoughts?
Well, I do think that I appear before you, and why I want to retain the position is mostly that the commission generally has tried to be, not to be influenced by political, as much by politics in its decision. I mean, we make the decisions based on the record that's before us. And so I think in many ways that this whole episode presents many undesirable precedents for the commission. I do think that in moving commissioners from one seat to the other, in addition to the qualification that should be examined by the legislature, but this is also opens the door to additional maneuvering, if you will, where it's at any time some. Because this kind of thing could open to the possibility of removing any commissioner at any time.
I understand. That's a little different question. I'm sure Chairman Donnelly will get into that during the hearing over the Judiciary Committee. I think my question goes to the heart of qualifications for that particular seat. And your qualifications are here. You had to meet those qualifications before your name was submitted the last time. And then this was forwarded to the clerk, apparently, with the carbon copy letter for your name this time. The other name, Mr. Foster, who's on the other end, has not been submitted yet to the legislature for consideration in this seat. Your name precedes that name. So I don't consider it an already done deal, so to speak, that seat is occupied by someone. My impression is it's still an open seat. And if the transmittal letter is correct, of which we'll cover in the other committee, then you're rightfully before this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Parnell. I too share Representative Parnell's feelings on this. Although we're not going to try to resolve any of the legal issues surrounding it, and there is a great difference of opinion among members of the legislature and probably this committee as well, I personally have been outraged by the whole process here, and most of it comes from following the commission over the years and seeing that the commission has managed to establish itself as a entity that isn't controlled by legislature, isn't controlled by the executive, that it's a separate entity representing the consumer, and we, you know, don't have too many of those in the state. One of the things I've been most interested in, and the whole state for that matter, is following the telephone issues and telephone deregulation. And just to fill us in, where were things, when you left the commission, where was the status of the deregulation or the GCI Alaskan battle with intrastate and phone calls?
When I left the commission, the groundwork was largely completed on some of the issues, but there were still a lot of side issues that had to be resolved. So the commission did promulgate regulations for the market structure of interstate competition, and also has completed work on access charges. Access charges is before Alaskan settled with the local telephone companies on a known separations and settlements basis. So they got together and agreed what the costs were for the local companies to carry long distance calls. Now when you go to a world where you have different long distance carriers, it becomes much more complicated on how to compensate local companies for their completing long-distance calls. So all of those mechanisms, the access charge regulations, the work was completed. There were the side issues that we still had to look at is how to handle long operator calls for directory assistance. The commission also, I think, finally did come up with after I left, with a resolution, at least a temporary resolution, of how to handle the dialing problems, because of the different machines in the state work differently, and so how does a customer access Alaskan or GCI or some other carrier without that dialing an infinite amount of numbers. So there was some of these technical issues, and like a direct assistance, it becomes a real complicated problem. Billing collection. So there were some mechanisms, the details had to be worked out. But overall, you know, the market structure regulations were in place. Thing that still I think has to be completed is the rates, how to weigh the exact weights that are given to access charges, because to encourage service to the bush, the commission has in its regulation has made a way that long-distance companies would pay less to terminate in the bush than in the metropolitan areas, and all of these rates were then averaged as to encourage service to the bush. So the exact determination of these weights and the formulas and all this, that still had to be resolved.
Other questions? One of the big issues we've got before legislature and even this committee is some of the electrical projects we've got in the state. And without getting into the details and the pros and cons of the various alternatives out there in the world of electrical generation, electrical transmission, I was wondering if you could offer any thoughts just on your general philosophy on these projects. What kind of criteria? Are we covering the kind of criteria in our state laws now that are important? I know the commission comes in at a late end a lot of times in some of these things, but your involvement approving power sales agreements, some of the other steps, seems to be important, and certainly it's got a lot of attention in the case of the recent healing.
I just heard the commission's decision on healing. I was not at all involved, and basically that was just the decision was based entirely on what was before the commission. And I really don't want to get too much into the Healy case because I really don't know enough about it. It does seem that one has to, if I could make a decision, I, for example, would like to know pretty precisely what a regular coal plant would cost as compared to this experimental plan. And generally, experiments in Alaska in some cases became very, very expensive. You know, like the switch in Bethel, General Telephone put in a new switch in Bethel and had technicians there for, I think, 2 years before the backend was working. So Model 1, Serial 1 in the bush, I don't think that's a good idea. But overall, again, I will say I don't know enough about the Healy plan. As to least cost energy planning, I certainly think it's important that that be done. I think the commission should work as a catalyst in encouraging this on part of the utilities. And some of the utilities are doing that, but they don't have any schedules. And I think it should be a systematic way of planning. That's important. I think that's crucial. And I think the commission, first of all, can act to bring the utilities together and then also work out when controversies arise, which undoubtedly will arise because some of these utilities are in competition, like ENSTAR and say the electric utilities. In some ways, they may very well be in competition, especially where there's an excess power at this point, electric power.
Any other questions from any committee members? Appreciate your coming before us today. There may be any questions that come up later. We'll submit them to you in writing. Just for the to make the record clear, we're going to have Don Schroer, the more recent attempt at appointing before us, in holding that confirmation hearing. There isn't any explicit or implicit recognition that he's properly before us. We've just left that decision to the Judiciary Committee. We're going to hold hearings on him as we have on you, just to look at the qualifications of the individuals involved and not attempt to address any of the legal issues. We certainly don't want to create any presumption of validity, though, in our attempts to do so.
I appreciate very much for this opportunity to appear before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments before we go back to bills? I'm not sure if we have Jeff Bush with us yet. Is Jeff with us yet? Okay, we will then skip past. We will skip past House Bill 240 and put that as the bottom list, and we will hear now House Bill 194, and I think we'll hold hearings on them both at the same time, House Bill 194 and House Bill 162. Anyone from the public who wants to testify will be able to comment on those. We're joined today by Representative Davis. Thank you for being here, and the floor is yours. We are, I think.
Thank you. I will pass out, Mr. Chairman, a committee substitute that we prepared. It has some minor changes, a couple of major changes that have come up since it passed to its last committee. testified on House Bill 194. The legislatures of all coastal states have, by statute, created boards or commissions to govern the operation of pilots of their respective states, for the appointment and licensing of such pilots, and frequently for the fixing of rates for pilots. Such boards and commissions are administrative agencies and, as such, are creatures of statute. The jurisdiction and authority which they assert must be found within the statutes under which they were created. House Bill 194 gives Alaska's Board of Marine Pilots this jurisdiction and authority. Mr. Chairman, it has been almost 20 years since any major changes were made regarding piloting in Alaska. Since introducing this bill, I've been told by some people things are fine. If it isn't broken, don't fix it. While I don't feel our pilotage regulations are broken, I do feel they can use some much-needed maintenance. Pilots play an important, integral part of transportation in Alaska. Pilots are taken on board at a particular place for the purpose of conducting the ship through inside coastal waters or from or into a port. It is their local knowledge that ensures the safe passage of vessels through our waters. This bill is a product of compromise. I've met with several representatives from the shipping industry, pilot board members, pilots, and pilot organizations. I have taken into consideration all of their comments and requests and incorporated those constructive suggestions into this bill. The law of tug, tow, and pilotage, I believe you have a copy of that in your packets, gives a history of everything you could ever want to know about piloting. It gives a history of the pilotage industry and cites court cases that back up the need for a strong pilot board. Giving the board the statutory power to enforce and regulate its pilots will serve in the best interest of Alaska. The committee substitute that's before you, as compared to House Bill 194, has a number of changes. In Section 3, it changes the number of yearly meetings to a phrase that says up to four. This is a recommendation essentially from the original draft study that it said that there would be additional meetings necessary, at least initially, to develop some more comprehensive regulations if this bill were passed. Section 6, it adds language that says a person may not be licensed for more than one pilotage region at one time. We've been back and forth on this. There's still folks, particularly within the industry, that would prefer to see pilots licensed for more than one region. They wouldn't have to pay as large of pilotage fees. They feel if they could have a Southeast pilot, for instance, go all the way up into Whittier or in Seward. There are some very good reasons why local, again, back to the local knowledge issue, that having the states separated into regions. In other states, they mostly do it into separate ports. You have one port.
Jerry, I hate to interrupt you, but you're describing the difference between the committee substitute and the previous bill.
Yeah.
No, it may be real helpful to the committee, and it certainly would be to me to describe the overall bill,
okay,
only because I don't
Should
understand
I just
it that well,
follow
so.
Through with the committee substitute and describe that versus and not just ignore the other bill?
Yeah, I think that'd be best.
Okay.
We just start and just tell us everything this does to change existing
okay.
law.
Okay. Section 1 includes the findings, and they're just sort of outlining the legislative intent behind having a pilot board and having them have the authority that we're giving them, the additional authority we're giving them in this bill. Section 2, section on appointment and term of office of the pilotage board. We've added public members of that board. That was again a suggestion from the study that was done last year. The section 3 is a section I just described, up to four meetings. It increases the number of meetings possible only because we're concerned about the timeline on being able to draft all these regulations. And we're giving the board extensively more power than they've had in the past. So. Section 4 then is highlighting the powers and duties of the board. And in a nutshell, what we're trying to do is we're trying to give the board broad authority to be able to provide for extensive training, examination of and issuances of licenses, the ability to audit pilot organizations, to impose disciplinary sanctions. Many of these things are sort of somewhat alluded to in the current statute, but they're not made very clear, and a lot of them, there have been some problems with trying to enforce anything that the board has done strictly by regulation, so we're outlining what they can do by regulation in this bill. Section 5 adds a new concept, and that's an student pilot coordinator. The object of this would be have a person who could working for the board would investigate complaints, et cetera. There doesn't seem to be anything right now that the board themselves can't do, go out and do these things, but that's the only possibility. So we've put in a pilot coordinator. We're envisioning this person as somebody like a retired Marine pilot or something like that would probably be have qualifications to carry out these duties. Section 6 is the license, and it talks about that's the section we're talking about not being licensed for more than one pilot in each region at a time. I think that will be discussed probably by a number of people at test. Section 7 just talks about the timeline when you're applying for to be licensed to take the test. Section 8, again, it's just talking about technicalities about examinations. Section 9 is a new section that talks about qualifications for a deputy marine pilot license. This is essentially a step between you get some training before you even become a deputy, and then when you become a deputy, you go through another series of training before you're ever able to become a licensed pilot in and of your own right. Then we've got training programs for the deputy marine pilot license, qualifications. Section 10 is qualifications for marine pilot license. Section 11, renewal of licenses, is some more specific language than was in current statute. There's in section 12, gives some specifics about lapsed licenses and what the board can do to renew someone if they have to go through some criteria for that. Section 13 is disciplinary sanctions section and has been updated to include drug use and alcohol use and those kinds of concerns. Section 14 is the section that is kind of the crux of the whole bill, mandatory employment of licensed pilots, and it speaks to the state's interest in having pilots on board vessels that are navigating the waters of or adjacent to or to the extent permitted by federal law, the state. And then it also speaks to the vessel being under the direction and control of a marine pilot unless the marine pilot is removed for cause. You hear quite a bit about that section. Liability section talks about a limitation of liability. The intent behind this is really more for the sake of, well, there's two problems. One is that insurance is not readily available to insure a pilot for the cost of some of these enormously expensive vessels and cargoes, et cetera, that for the ships that they pilot. And what happens now is what insurance they do get, they charge off to the people who are employing them, to the ship owners in any event. It's sort of a double coverage in a way because they're covered under their insurance and another insurance. This is a section I expect will get worked over in the Judiciary Committee. We're amenable to changing the limits upwards, and we're certainly amenable to looking at other changes in that language, but there's a specific intent behind that, and this is similar to what they do in other states. There's also in this section a discussion about limitation of liability for the regional organizations who are going to be training new pilots as they come in. And again, those are sections that we will be discussing at length, I'm sure. Section 16 just talks about the pilot's need for compensation. Section 17 is discussing regional organizations, and it's allowing the board to recognize regional organizations. It does not limit that to one organization per region, as originally we talked about in this original version of the bill. I think there's probably some good reasons to do that, but we have acceded to the wishes of a number of folks in the industry who didn't like that language, and so we've taken it out and we've just allowed the board to recognize organizations, period. If it were to recognize as many as they wanted to under this language. Section 18 is language that discusses the exemptions to to Alaska mileage, and they're already in current law. We've added a couple of updates that were necessary. Section 19 is essentially what we've had in current law. Section 20 is a penalty section that's been updated, increased penalties. Cleanup language. And then there's some transitional time frames for people who are already serving as pilots that may not meet as this stringent language, stringent training requirements that we have in this law, if this were to pass. And I would be happy to answer any questions. I would imagine that a number of people that are here to testify will be able to answer some of your questions in even greater depth than I could.
Thank you, Sherry. Are there any questions from any committee members? If you have the time, if you could join us at the table, we'd appreciate it. We can get another table if something shows up. First person we'll hear is Joseph Merrill. Actually, I should say first, is there anyone from the administration who want to testify? Angie, you want to testify on this or just answer questions?
Probably just answer specific questions.
Okay, why don't we just put that off later since more issues are raised, and I think that'd work out better. Mr. Merrill?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here on the day that's not raining. I represent the Alaska Marine Pilots Dispatch Services that is headquartered in Dutch Harbor and serves that area of the state. Prior to getting into a couple of specifics, I would like to say that I'm somewhat of a novice of this lobbying business and one thing or another, but I've been overly impressed, really, with the responsiveness of the members, especially Representative Davis's office, that have been able to suggest in their response and encouragement and one thing or another, and it's kind of renewed my faith in government to that extent, because I felt awfully good that we've been welcome and our input has been valuable. So I thank her for that. We appreciate the difficulty of drafting legislation that balances out the interest of various parties, the pilots, the shipping, and the public. And I hope that my remarks can be taken in a conciliatory tone, because I think the bill has almost exclusively positive things. I don't think the world will end if it isn't passed. I think that if it is, that some major improvements can be made in the piloting industry. But our organization supports the bill as represented by the committee substitute that is a little bit more specific on the deputy pilots. We feel that a lot of the grievances of pilot organizations have stemmed from hindrances at the board level where their powers have not been clear, such as setting tariffs and approving training programs, and this bill addresses those things in a positive way. We feel that it, in a very positive manner, establishes more rigorous training and entry criteria, and that that's a very positive aspect of it, that the deputy pilot concept is an important feature of it, that a person somewhat, in my other life I'm a CPA, and I know that to get a CPA license after passing the exam, you still have to work for 2 years for someone before you can claim the title. And the deputy concept is that same type of thing, that an individual takes an exam, has training, and is able to begin to earn a living, but for a few years they're limited in what they can do, and I think that's a positive aspect of it. I think the bill adequately prevents monopolistic tendencies of pilot organizations. I don't feel that it helps or hinders or limits in any way any organization. It recognizes that the board has the authority to check into their bylaws and operating rules, that the board has the authority to approve their training programs, and I think those are positive aspects that keep it from being a monopoly. And from the initial drafts of this bill to its present form, that aspect has been greatly improved upon, and we feel pretty comfortable with that. I think also that it incorporates the basic and most important recommendations of the study done by OMB, which was a very good study. We do realize that, everyone would write something a little bit different in a little bit different language, and that you could spend your life trying to get agreement as to the exact terminology. But we feel that the underlying concepts are clearly stated, and the few words that may be subject to interpretation can be dealt with either by the parties involved meeting and clarifying what they, or the Judiciary Committee. The one major flaw that I would see in the bill is that if it incorporates the one license for one region concept, that the transition rules in Section 24 have to be redone so that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. That if it's good for a new pilot to be limited to one area, that it's good for an old pilot to be limited to one area. That if someone has the license to cover the entire state and we're emphasizing local knowledge, that they shouldn't continue to have a license for the entire state. And I have some substitute language for that if you're interested. But overall, I think that the bill deals with the major things that would improve the piloting industry, that the few little picky things are not impossible to reconcile between the various parties. And so I would urge that your action be positive and that the bill passes on to others. I'll be happy to respond to any questions or any other help that I can give you.
Any questions you might have? If you could leave us with the language that you had in mind, that'd be helpful. I understand your point on that. Thank you for joining us today. We'll go next to Tom McAllister in Valdez. Mr. McAllister, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm the Forest Operations Coordinator for the City of Valdez, and I support this legislation. I feel that it's got a lot more authority in it for the board than what the old bill on the books for the last 20 years have had, and maybe this will give them the authority to do their work in their capacity that needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying. Any questions? Okay. Next, we'll go to Soldotna to Dennis Lodge.
Dennis Lodge here in Soldotna. I represent the Alaska Bull Tech Center in Seward, where we have a marine training department. And in the last few months, we've obtained a computer simulation of Prince William Sound, which enables us to train marine pilots in a number of skills which they wouldn't normally obtain in real life. For example, we can simulate groundings in strong tidal and wind conditions. We can simulate ice and its effect on the traffic. The simulation was obtained on a floppy disk that was produced in Finland for us at $40,000. So it's a very exact simulation, and it fits into our Raycal Deca radar simulator. pilotage training that we're giving revolves around radar simulation. And the Coast Guard have inspected our facility the past few months and decided that the simulation is good enough to allow a pilotage candidate to write off three round trips from Hinchinbrook to the Port of Valdez. Normally, of course, the candidate needs 14 round trips to obtain the license, but with our simulation of 3 round trips, they'd only need 11 extra trips in real life. The problem that I see is that I don't have a pilotage license, and I'm running the simulator, and I notice in the old bill that the board requires that the person training pilots to have a pilotage license himself. I would point out that some very good simulation training is being given at the National Maritime Academy in Kings Point, New York, and the instructors over there don't have Alaskan pilotage licenses. There are also some fine simulation schools in Europe that many Alaskan pilots attend for upgrading purposes, and the instructors in those facilities also don't have Alaskan pilotage licenses. So I would like to see some slight change in the wording in section 10, where there is a waiver given to some of the pilotage training schools to the extent that the person training the pilots need not necessarily have an Alaskan pilotage license himself. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parnell had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you be able to supply the committee with the Coast Guard either the certification or the authorization where they've signed off on the training and the condensing of the numbers of times?
Yes, I can forward you the letter which they sent to us. Where would I, what's the actual address I would send it to, Representative?
Mr. Chairman?
If you could actually find some means to fax it here to be of the best help to us. I'm not sure what our fax number is, but we'll 465-2444 and put to the either Representative Parnell or the Labor and Commerce Committee on, and they'll get to it. Any other questions from committee members?
Next up, early next week. I'm out of my office at the moment in Soldotna. When I get back next Monday, I'll certainly fax off the letter which the Coast Guard sent to us, authorizing us to write off these 3 round trips for pilotage candidates, specifically in Prince William Sound. Just since the oil spill, and that's given added impetus for the Votec Center to provide this additional training.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll next go to Terry Bennett here in Juneau.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Terry Bennett. I represent Alaska Coastwise Pilots Association. We're an independent group competing with the Southeastern Alaska Pilot Association. Our office is at 174 South Franklin Street, Juneau. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to testify today. This bill would put us out of business. There is nothing in this bill that would have prevented the Exxon Valdez disaster. There's nothing in the bill that would prevent a recurrence. This bill has been dressed up in the language of safety, rather like a child clutching a security blanket while walking away in tears and terror from a burning house. This bill does not improve navigational safety. The real intent is to destroy economic competition and control the marketplace from entry to exit, with minimum interference from a benign oversight board. The net result of the bill's aspects, entry requirements, control of training levels by FIPA and SWAPA, and an all-inclusive tariff enforcement, regional licensing restrictions, is a statutory, the effect of that is that it's a statutory, it grants a statutory monopoly insulated from the effects of its inevitable abuse of power by the bill's additional protections from liability and antitrust lawsuits. By the way, and on that point, there are two litigations in progress now, and this bill would have an effect on those litigations. The two dominant pilot associations have themselves given rise to an environment which is target-rich for competitive opportunity. In my opinion, a group capable of competing with SEPA and SWAPA, SWAPA being Southwest Alaska Pilots Association, is a good thing for the state because it provides the most effective operational check and balance system in an endeavor that is not entirely understood by a wide range of people. It's good for industry because it should result in some reduction of cost for piloting service, a savings that some of which I personally hope the companies would pass on to the poorest paid of their shipboard crew members. Competition is good for the various pilot associations for the same reason it's good for the state. It keeps us honest. In closing, I urge the committee to view us, ACP, that is Alaska Coastwise Pilots, as somewhat akin to that previously mentioned child. We are strong enough to compete if you, our surrogate parents, even out the playing field. And you can do that by keeping.
I was interested in the comment about a couple of lawsuits. I would think whatever, if there is a current lawsuit that with new legislation, that it would be moot. This would not affect a current lawsuit because it wasn't in place at the time.
Ma'am, I'm not an attorney, so I can't really respond in that way to that question. I don't know what impact the proposed legislation would have on the current litigation.
Oh, perhaps I misunderstood. I thought you said that the legislation would have an impact.
It will have an impact,
lawsuit.
But I don't know what that is.
But you don't know what or how.
Yes, ma'am. I do know that it would prevent similar litigation in the future, and it's important to have some.
What litigation are you referring to?
Antitrust, a whole panoply of perhaps the tortious interference with the contractual relationship, antitrust actions, restraint of trade, improper conduct, all kinds of things.
And you're a member of an organization of pilots?
Yes,
marine
ma'am.
Pilots?
We are an independent organization of marine pilots. In competition with Southeastern Alaska Pilots Association in Southeast Alaska, as far west as Yakutat.
And are you saying you don't wish to be regulated, or it would really cut you out of the workforce?
No, this bill, as it sits before you, in my opinion, would have the effective result of putting my group out of business. And we're an organization which has members totaling over 200 years of experience as a group in Southeast Alaska.
Would you join this organization, combined?
Join which? One of the two existing dominant groups? It's a subject that has been raised for discussion. I doubt after today there'll be too many more offers.
Thank you.
Representative Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What kind of lawsuit are you referring to?
Currently, two, I think, antitrust lawsuits working their way through the courts, one here in federal court, and I think the other in federal court in Anchorage, but I'm not positive.
Who are the parties in the lawsuits?
One is a member of SEPA, and the other is a member of my group, Alaska Coastwise Pilots. The first is Captain Michael Spence, the second is Captain Joseph Holman.
And it's your determination that if this were passed, it would have an effect on the outcome of those two lawsuits?
I don't know what the outcome would be. I think that if it were passed, it might have an impact on that litigation. It was my information that, and the reason I mentioned it was my information that the legislative committees like to know whether or not there is litigation pending. That's the only reason I bring it up. I'm not competent to speak to it. There are other aspects of this bill which I could speak to that with a little more authority regarding their deleterious effect on my group.
Well, I'd like to know about that too, but also, could you provide us with the names of someone who can clarify the legal status and what impact that might have if we were to pass this?
Yes, sir, I can.
I appreciate that. If you could.
Sure. The first would be the law firm locally of Dillon and Finley.
Dillon and Finley?
Right. In addition to that, the law firm of Richard Pennington in Anchorage. And I believe that representatives from SEPA and SWAPA could provide the information regarding their attorneys. And as I said, I don't mean to imply anything more than what I said. It was my information that you folks like to know these things. What impact it has, I don't know.
Okay, well, that's what we need to know.
Okay.
If it will have an impact, if so, what is it? And then, on your own organization, why is it going to be so different? It's a hundred to your group.
Well,
how does it do that?
It puts the control of access to the industry primarily in the hands of the two dominant groups. This bill is based on a previous marine piloted study, which was terribly flawed, which was in itself based on a previous letter to the governor from a pilot from Southwest Alaska, which had any number of inaccuracies in it. These things seem to have built on themselves until finally we come down to this bill. And some of those inaccuracies were used to justify certain aspects of this bill. For instance, the need for protected monopoly status that would prevent people from filing nuisance lawsuits. It's rubbish. There has to be some means of legal redress when you're harmed by other people, and this bill would prevent that in large measure. This bill destroys competition because it has in it a section which would allow for a very strict enforcement of the tariff, which is not spelled out anywhere.
Where are you? What section?
I'm on page 7, line 21, under the section which I believe speaks to disciplinary measures. Number 7, line 21.
Where it says charges, collects, or receives an amount from your pilot services.
Right. If there were a strict interpretation of this, it means that a pilot who did not charge for instance, an out-of-area charge, but who might have to stay on the vessel as much for his own convenience as for that of the shipping company, and they have a mutual interest in saving money and therefore are able to do that, could be charged under this bill and his license either suspended or revoked depending on how strict they wanted to enforce it.
And where was the other section you're referring to?
Another one that comes to mind immediately is the one in which the board is allowed to recognize whatever number of pilot organizations it wishes. That says they can, as Representative Davis, who, by the way, I before I go any further, should thank for the access she has allowed me and members of my persuasion in this issue, access to her and her staff for our input as well. And thank you very much.
Where's that other?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It says that the board may recognize any number of the pilot organizations.
On bottom of page 8.
Oh, thank you. Line 31. The board may recognize organizations of marine pilots within each marine piloted region. Well, the board may recognize 20, the board may recognize 1. I submit that the board ought to be concerned with licensing requirements and leave the number of groups that 125 pilots want to gather themselves into to those pilots. That the pilots know who they want to freely associate with. They deal with collegiality all the time because they live in such close working relationship. And I don't believe that that belongs with the board, and I believe that if the board did recognize only one pilot group, my group would be out of business. We would either be swallowed up by the other group, those of whom were acceptable to the other dominant groups, or we would be simply out of business.
Are there other sections, or do you...
Yes, the antitrust, I believe that the antitrust provisions would prevent us from bringing suit for what we perceive to be wrongs committed against us by the dominant groups. Whether or not they have any merit should be determined in court, not by the Board of Marine Pilots and not by one group of pilots who are dominant. The training levels are another example. There are senior pilots sitting in this room who could not qualify under this bill for a deputy pilot's license if they were starting out today. This legislation will require grandfathering.
Representative Brucker.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to page 8, line 31, the way I read it, what the board could recognize many organizations. So I'm a little confused. I don't understand your dismay.
You're quite right. The board may. That also, the converse of that is the board may not.
True, but again, I think we would look at the qualifications of each, and I don't see where competition would be wiped out, as you seem to think, if the board could recognize more than one.
Well, I think I would feel much better if the language said the board shall recognize more than one organization. In addition to that, I strongly urge you to reconsider the tariff aspects of this. My group feels that there should be a set enforceable tariff, yes, but it ought to be minimal, or rather there ought to be plenty of room in there for competitive maneuvering. There are any number of aspects to the tariff that do not encompass just taking the ship in or out of port. There's overtime provisions, there's out-of-area charges, there's travel, there's all kinds of things that allow a group which has less overhead, perhaps, to be able to cut away some of the fat, save the shipping company money, and still work at a profit. And in fact, in my case, I did a job last summer that if I had done that same job under the same conditions working for SEPA, I would have made 25% less than what I made working for that company, giving them a financial incentive to hire me.
Any other questions for committee members? I appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we've got Edward Murphy.
Thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Edward Murphy, representing the Southwest Alaska Pilot Association. I've been piloting in Alaska for about 17 years, vessels of all sizes and types, chief among which are the tankers training at Prince William Sound. I served as 4 years on the Alaska Board of Marine Pilots and chaired the board for 3. I've got some prepared testimony. I'll try to go over it briefly and hope you'll have some questions. Last year, I wrote Governor Cooper a letter concerning grave safety problems I saw emerging in Alaska state piloting system. Among them were the lowest entry standards for licensing in the entire country, no state-mandated standards or requirements for pilot training, control and manipulation of state pilots by outside steamship companies and agents, pilot board difficulties in maintaining and upgrading pilot standards, inordinate delays in pilot discipline cases, legal problems for pilot associations in training pilots and maintaining high standards in the absence of state requirements. The governor responded to the concerns expressed in my letter by ordering his Office of Management and Budget to conduct an independent study of Alaska state piloting system and to make recommendations for improvement based on the study findings. The result of the staff study is a booklet entitled Improving Alaska's Marine Piloting System. Now, the document is remarkably thorough and thoughtful look at pilots in Alaska, written by researchers who have no particular axe to grind except the public interest. If you have not already done so, I urge you to read the study. It will tell you far better than I can the problems with our state's piloting system and the need for legislative change to the Marine Pilot Statutes. House Bill 194 represents a collaborative effort between the Southeastern and Southwest Pilot Associations, working with Representative Davis and her staff, and to the extent we can with industry. We believe it's legislation that you'll be able to support, probably support, and I'd like to tell you why. The finding section on the first page, for the first time, make it clear that the public service, the nature of a pilot's work, by stating the first and paramount duty of Marine pilots is to provide for the public safety and the protection of the marine environment. It says that Marine pilots operating independently of the shipping industry, I want to emphasize that, operating independently of the shipping industry, have provided and will continue to provide essential service to the state. The independence of the pilot from the ship owner's interest and control is a crucial element of safety long recognized by state pilots and identified by the study staff. The federal government recognizes this essential element of piloting in the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 by, for the first time in history, requiring state pilots, Alaska state licensed pilots, who are not a member of the ship's crew, to pilot tankers in certain sections of Prince William Sound. The bill clearly establishes the powers and duties of the Board of Marine Pilots. The ambiguity in the existing law, I think you've already heard about, has caused a number of problems. The Board is essentially unable to act. The bill raises the entry standards for pilot license applicants. The staff study, pages 15 through 17, clearly illustrate how remarkably low Alaska standards are. The American Pilot Association says they're the lowest in the country. The bill establishes a deputy pilot system whereby new pilots can be trained under the supervision of veterans. The bill declares that the pilot board will establish standards for training programs. Incredibly, pilot training is not addressed under current statute. The staff study pointed out the essential element of local knowledge in all piloting and recommended that Alaska's vast coastline be divided into pilot regions, or pilots would be restricted to piloting in one region only. The bill permits the pilot board to establish regions but stops short of restricting pilots to a particular region. Without this requirement, regionalization is largely meaningless. I urge you to strengthen the bill by inserting such a requirement. In addition to the features of the bill previously listed, there are two more areas of concern which are equally crucial to a workable and professional pilot system. These are limiting pilot liability and permitting the pilot board to recognize certain pilot organizations. I emphasize plural organizations. The bill limits a pilot's liability and that of pilot organizations. Every time a pilot steps on a ship, he faces the possibility of financial ruin. This is in addition to possible criminal penalties he may suffer in the event the vessel he is piloting suffers an accident. These penalties were called for in House Bill 315, which you folks passed last year. Piloting is a high-risk profession, and few, if any, pilots can stand the sort of twin liabilities now emerging. Some sort of liability limitation is reasonable, as the legislatures of other maritime states have found. Washington is an example. It sets a limit of $5,000. Note that the bill before you does not limit liability if the pilot's error or negligence is willful. We don't think the amount of the liability limit is important at all. We'd like to see some sort of a limit set so that we can obtain insurance. But the most important element here is the protection from liability of pilot organizations who provide the training for pilots. We're caught in a terrible catch-22 if we train people as we must to have any sort of credibility. We're subject to lawsuit if that person has an accident, the litigant claiming that the person was improperly trained. If we fail to train people, we're also subject to lawsuits for training them. So for that reason, we're asking the state to impose training programs and to limit the liability of organizations who conduct them. The bill gives the board the authority to recognize organizations of Marine pilots for certain pilot regions of the state. It's important to recognize that the state cannot realistically maintain its own pilot training and dispatch service. Pilots form themselves into organizational structures called associations for this purpose. The associations provide pilots, central dispatching, employees, boats, equipment, pilot stations, radios, and communications equipment, transportation, training, and administration of the whole as a system. We do this with Alaska resident pilots, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, in every kind of weather. House Bill 194 recognizes these facts and requires groups of pilots to do certain things in order to be recognized. It requires compliance with state standards in terms of non-discrimination, promoting professional pilot service, maintaining sufficient pilots to serve area shipping, and maintaining programs. The bill does not franchise any particular group, nor does it require industry to use members of a particular group, nor does it require an individual to be a member of a particular group. Alaska's original State Pilotage Act of 1970 has changed little since it was enacted, yet shipping in the state has increased manyfold with larger and faster ships carrying more dangerous cargoes and an ever-increasing number of passengers. Often these ships ply the waters of Alaska with only one United States citizen aboard. That person is the ship's pilot, who is licensed by the state of Alaska. The consequences of the pilot's failure to adequately meet the demands placed upon him can have profound consequences for the marine environment and the citizens of Alaska. The pilot's role is a public service one. Alaska citizens have a right to expect that state pilots have met high entry standards, have undergone rigorous training, and possess extensive local knowledge. As the OMB study group recognized, safety demands that pilots be independent and free of the ship owner or his agent's interest or control. We think House Bill 194 or something close to it is long overdue, and we ask you to consider it favorably. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Any questions for you, members? I have one. The first of all, what years were you on the Marine Pilotage Board?
Let's see.
Just generally, I
84 through 87, I believe. Through 88, pardon.
I don't really understand some of the basics of all this. And so if you could go back to what the status quo is right now, how things have been working. Has there been any significant changes in the statutes on Marine pilots in the last 5 years, or has it been?
No, there hasn't been any. There have been a few regulatory changes, but no statutory changes.
So right now, there's an existence, two or three of these regional pilots organizations?
The situation in the state is this, and we might as well confront it head on and talk about it. For the last nearly 20 years, there have been two major pilots organize themselves into groups called associations. We're self-employed independent contractors, and we voluntarily organize ourselves in associations. This isn't anything new. This has been done in every maritime state in the country since forever. In this state, the Southeast Alaska pilots provided most of the pilotage service in southeastern Alaska. The Southwest Alaska pilots provided service throughout the rest of the state. A number of years ago, an individual who was with the Southwest pilots broke away, started a competing group in western Alaska, whom you've heard from Mr. Merrill, he represents them. They've been pretty successful and have seemed to have provided a pretty good service. There is emerging now, apparently, at least two people I know of, both of whom are not residents of this state, who are organizing a pilot group to compete with the Southeastern Alaska pilots. This is a hard one for people not in the pilot business to buy, but it's a fact that competition in the pilotage world is not in the public interest. Excuse me, I'd like to tell you why. If I have to go out and advertise my services and vie for jobs with particular ship owners by offering special deals, cut rate tariffs, and so forth, I have sacrificed my independence as a public servant of this state, providing a service to the people as well as earning an income. In terms of giving up my independence, I'm certainly not implying that independent pilots are necessarily irresponsible, but they do have financial pressure, the ship owner's financial pressure, financial commercial interests in mind all the time. The ship owner's in a position perhaps to say, hey, if you don't do it this way, I'll find somebody who will. Let me give you an example. A number of years ago, a short anecdote, I was coming into Valdez with a cruise ship. The name of it isn't important. Early in the morning, dense fog. I slowed the ship, started sounding fog signals. There were a lot of fishing boats on the radar outbound. And the captain came bounding up on the board and raised hell with me. He said, "Hey, I've got 600 passengers here, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. You can't blow that whistle." And I explained to him that we had to do it. This was Alaska, the United States, and he and I had an unfortunate confrontation. These kinds of things happen upon occasion. I guess if I were employed by that company exclusively, perhaps I'd have been a little more reluctant to confront the captain. The independent nature of piloting is absolutely essential. I think the state's business is to maintain that, to set a tariff that everybody has to charge for. If pilot groups want to compete in terms of providing a better service, hooray. But to compete in terms of price and go out and buy like a commercial enterprise is not in the public's interest.
In terms, again, of the status quo, what's the relationship between government, between the state, and these organizations? What role do they play now?
There is no official recognition or even mention in the Alaska Pilotage Act or in the regulations about pilot organizations and pilot associations. Pilots in the United States have, to my knowledge, have always evolved to an association, because an association, as I said in my prepared testimony, can pool all its resources in terms of pilotage service and financial to maintain an entire system of 24-hour dispatch with pilot boats, a transportation system, communications, and so forth. So it's always been the logical way. Also, pilots have recognized that the steamship industry is a whole lot stronger than individual pilots. And so much in the way union members or potential union members have joined a union, pilots have associated themselves to be able to provide service in an effective, efficient way, and to be able to deal with commercial interest steamship companies on some sort of an equitable basis. And so right now, the Alaska statute says nothing about pilot organizations.
In looking at this bill and your views on this bill, if you took out the statement that allows them to associate with the organizations, or on the bottom of page 8 there, recognizing organizations, what would be the significance of that if they weren't allowed to recognize? I'm just trying to understand what this is all about in implementing the
law. Well, I think it's what it does is recognize reality. And also there's the OMB staff and their study proposed a social contract in return for the pilots and their organizations, associations maintaining this pilot system, conducting training and so forth. What the state would do would recognize organizations as long as it was established that they met certain criteria and give them some sort of antitrust protection. If you look closely at the language of the bill, this antitrust protection is only tied to regional organizations that are recognized. What I'm saying is, I think the way it would work is if an organization met the state's criteria, whatever they happen to be, and are recognized, they could fall under this antitrust proposal. But if they didn't jump through the hoops that the state pilot board wants them to in terms of non-discrimination, 24-hour service, and so on and so forth, they wouldn't get this kind of protection. And I think that's the social contract is the phrase that the OMB staff used.
And what's the significance if they're not allowed to have this recognition?
I don't think there's going to be a particular change in what goes on now. Pilots will band together in associations or other organizational structures for the reasons I've talked about.
I just still have a tough time understanding what it means to recognize them and what it's going to change.
Well, I think it's an attempt by the state to say, hey, we're going to recognize you, but if you want to be recognized, you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z. You're going to have to maintain it. You're going to have to not discriminate. You're going to have to provide service on an on-call basis. You're going to have to conduct a training program that complies with our standards and so forth.
And just so we have before us, where's the part about not discriminating? That's under the renewal of life. That's under the.
I think it's under regional law.
Page 9, line 7. Uniform non-discrimination application article.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Page 9, line 7.
Okay, good. Right there. There are other questions, Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I guess just to follow up on that a little bit, what we're doing is we're, in this bill, by recognizing pilot organizations, we're also regulating pilot organizations, allowing the board to regulate pilot organizations. And some of the things that they do, I mean, all the things they do now, they do voluntarily. But if they did not choose to, for instance, maintain a training program to provide us with additional new pilots as, you know, as they're needed, and et cetera, if they did not choose to do some of these things, we don't have any clout now. But if we have it in statute that the board can recognize these organizations, but they also can regulate them and ensure that they do all these things that we as a state think they ought to do, then we've got some clout over them. Right now, they are not under our control in any way.
Then the issue that was raised earlier on the may versus shall, it doesn't seem like any of this is in conflict with the word shall. I mean, if they meet the requirements, there isn't anything in here that says they aren't going to be recognized. I mean, it seems possible to find a way to include the word shall, or to at least make clear there isn't some additional discretion put on the state here.
Mr. Chairman, right now I believe there's only one area of the state that has two associations, and that's Southeast. Is that not, if I'm right? There are no other areas where there are conflicting, competing groups of pilots right now that could come up, but right now it's not the case. If you say shall, they have to recognize more than one organization, which is what I understood the testimony to be. If there is no other organization to recognize, that seems a little shaky to me. What we've tried to do is we've tried to make the language as clear as possible to allow the board to recognize organizations that are following the board's guidelines, rules, and regulations, and not to have and to allow competition between those organizations if they would so choose, or have more than one organization in the region. Originally, we had the bill so that there was only one organization in each region, period. And we've altered that in our successive language of the bill in order to just to take care of the gentleman's concerns, so that there would be the ability to have more than one organization.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Bruckman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then if I understand the speaker right, sounds to me like a cruise ship line can just call ahead and ask for a pilot from one of
typically what
the organizations.
The process, right, under normal circumstances is a ship is going to whether it's a cruise ship or a log ferry or a tanker, is going to proceed to a certain port within Alaska. And in most cases, that shipping company has a local agent that represents its interest in the state, and the agent receives a message or another communication from the ship with its arrival time, and the agent then makes the appropriate arrangements, pilot, customs and immigration, whether the vessel's going to need any stores, and so on and so forth. So that's the process. The cruise ships are a little different in that their schedule is well known throughout the summer. They come and go pretty much like railroad trains. They're just right on time.
Okay. And then aside from this, would you refresh me 65 feet or something? Would need a pilot? Was it mentioned?
There's some language in here that just talks about the size of vessels that have to, we require pilots, and also that excludes some vessels that are taken care of under federal pilotage laws rather than state pilotage.
Thank you.
Any Representative
Swag? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to be today, go for it. Question that I've asked before, and I guess I'm still puzzled on it. We set up this regionalization, and you've got a pilot that comes out of the Aleutian Chain, or it comes out of Homer area. Somebody decides that he wants to live in Southeast Alaska. According to what I've been told and according to this, that individual who may be a 20-year pilot is suddenly going to have to go through and has probably got some excellent qualifications by everybody's standards, but suddenly because he decides he wants to move to Southeast Alaska and continue pilotage, he's going to have to go through all of his training and may not be eligible for certain tonnages according to this out there. My question is, why are we going to set up a system that suddenly is going to restrict the pilot who's probably been throughout the entire state of Alaska out there?
I don't, in my opinion, it's not going to work that way. At least I hope it doesn't. If a San Francisco Bay pilot wants to move to Seattle, for example,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm talking about an Alaska pilot.
Yes, sir. I'm just
making okay. Well, let's
example.
Kind of stay away from San Francisco and let's talk about an Alaskan okay. pilot who is serving the Aleutian Chain or serving Cook Inlet, who's suddenly moving to Southeast Alaska. He's been an Alaskan pilot for 10 to 20 years, and now he suddenly is going to have to be retrained or go through training because of he wants to be in this regionalized area.
I'm trying to answer your question. The way I think it will work, the way I hope it works, is if this person is indeed a veteran pilot and wants to pilot in another area, he will go through the training in terms of obtaining the pilotage endorsements, the local knowledge, and those tests. And what ship handling training you have to go through would depend upon his experience in the previous region. For example, if he came from the Aleutians, probably most of the experience would be on smaller fisheries-related cargo vessels. So he'd have probably good proficiency in those kinds of vessels. He'd have to be trained up on the larger vessels. And it really depends upon the individual's aptitude and level of expertise. It's impossible to say how long it would take. It really depends upon the individual. But I can't see any way a veteran pilot from one area who's been trained as a ship handler would have to go through an entirely new set of ship handling. He would have to be trained in the local knowledge aspect of the new area and on the particular ship types if they are different from the previous area he was in. That's the way I see it.
The Wrangell Narrows.
But that's only if he's never piloted in Southeast Alaska, even though many of the areas around the state are somewhat similar.
Well, it should be as hard as possible. This piloting business is, to make kind of a wild metaphor, this is the brain surgery of the maritime industry. The consequences for goofing up are pretty extreme. And I'm a lot more interested in high standards of training and performance while I believe in protecting everybody's rights, I'm a lot more worried about the former than the latter.
Yeah, the one other area that I guess maybe it just I have a personal problem with is always this assumption that independence versus somebody going and deciding to work for a shipper. You know, and with all the, this is more reflection on you and your organizations, and it brings back, you know, the hysteria of the Exxon Valdez and all of these problems. Suddenly all of this legislation that was flying all over both in the state and on the federal level, that somehow now the individual, because he's worked for a major corporation or decides to go to work for a major shipper, suddenly his qualifications or his expectations are tainted because he may be making deals out there. And that bothers me when, you know, anybody sits down and starts to throw out that because I'm independent, I'm always going to have a much higher standard versus somebody else who decides to go to work for a tourist firm or a corporation or a major shipper out there is suddenly going to start making his or her deals and is suddenly going to taint their qualifications out there. I will always have a problem with that, to suddenly throw out an accusation or an assumption on that when those people you may be talking about may have plied Alaskan's waters, again, as pilotage for 10 or 20 years, just because they decide to change an association or change a region, they suddenly become questionable. And I would hope that none of this in here starts to restrict them because of that assumption.
Mr. Zawacki, to my knowledge, it doesn't. I wouldn't support what it is that concerns you. I don't think we need such a thing. But the local knowledge, the piloting is two things. It's local knowledge and ship handling expertise. And if we're not going to talk about those things and tighten up the requirements, I'm sure we all have better things to do. But when a person is piloting in one geographic area and moves to another, it's a reasonable expectation the citizens of the state have that he will be trained, or she, in the new area. And if the ships that person was handling previously are not the same kinds of ships in the new area, that person will be trained on this new kind of ship. I see the training period is much shorter if the pilot from this region is a proficient pilot and moves over here. He gains local knowledge and whatever brush up on ship handling he needs for that class of ship, and away he goes. I don't see how it's starting from scratch again. But again, it depends upon the individual. It's a highly personal thing. There's no way to generalize.
Any other questions, Representative?
Just a comment and question following that. You know, if I understand this right, this bill will certainly standardize all the requirements of the Marine pilots as it states so in Section 1 findings. My only concern, and I've heard a couple testimony to that effect from the small pilot organizations, is their access provided to the other small pilot organizations that want to compete with the other groups or bigger organizations in this bill? Are those opportunities protected in this bill? I believe I've heard those, but assure me if they are.
Yes, indeed. We've tried to do that. We have, by not mandating that there is one pilot organization for a region, but indeed allowing the board to determine whatever number they want of pilotage organizations. And I would envision any pilotage organization that is formed would go to the board and say, we would like you to recognize us as an official pilot organization. Here's our bylaws and whatever that you can approve, because we make them do that. We make them go through a process with the board. But anybody that can do that is going to be able to be qualified as a group and be able to operate independently as a separate pilot organization. We're not trying to... The original bill had that language in there. We took it out. We took it out to what they call franchising. We took it out so that it allows multiple pilot organizations within regions if people want to have those.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming before us today.
Thank you.
And answering our questions as well. Next, we have Dale Collins. I would like to try to. We've got six people left to testify at least. If there are no, so we'll try to make them as quick as possible. I still need to go back to the bill we passed up earlier on the. Whatever the hell it was. The Unclaimed Property Act. It's a very obscure piece of law converted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep it brief. I feel that state polities right now is at a crossroads. This bill does nothing more than legitimize what exactly is going on in the state right now. It does not preclude Alaska Coastwise pilots, Aleutian pilots, Southeast pilots, Southwest pilots, or any other pilots from competing or organizing in any manner that they want. I may very well leave Southeast Alaska pilots myself and go into competition with 4 or 5. There are some flaws with the State Pilotage Act as it is right now. They are severe. Right now, if the state does not want to recognize a pilot but wants to recognize mandatory pilotage, and you don't feel it's necessary to set a tariff that's enforceable, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to set around until Christmas Eve, and I'm going to make my year's living on one ship. This has happened elsewhere in the course of history in the United States and elsewhere in the world. there's three elements that I think that any bill for the state's good should include. One, they should set a tariff that's enforceable and fair for shippers, pilots, and the state, and everyone involved. Two, a quality pilot should be able to go on board the ship and do the job with a high degree of skill. Right now, the State Powerage Act, as pointed out by other testifiers, this is seriously in question. We have pilots out there that industry has attacked. They were not welcome in a couple of the major groups or were severely criticized. It's funny, now that they're not in our group, they're welcome in the other group, and they are employed at a reduced rate. The other part that I'd like to make is that who's going to be out there right now, 365 days, 24-hour, an hour, out there protecting the waters or providing the service that we've said is mandatory? If it continues the way it is going, pilots will form into economic entities that are serve their own needs and not the needs of the state. I will go out there and cream the best jobs, the best lucrative ones, the low-risk jobs, summertime, high noon, and leave the dark winter work to some poor Alaska resident that has to go out there and adhere to some tariff that may or may not be in force. Or I'll do the opposite, and I'll work the winter months at a high rate and whatever the pressure can bear. To me, when you make mandatory pilots, you've stepped into a highly regulatory type of an entity that you have to regulate. The State's Pilotage Act worked very well voluntarily when there was two groups that were basically volunteered to act in a cooperative manner with the state in harmony. Our standards exceed the state standards. Many pilots that have dropped out of the two major organizations have done so because they do not want to meet our standards. Our standards are superior to the state's. This bill would bring, if the board approved them, we're not setting the standards. The Board of Marine Pilots will set the standards and will say what is good for the state, not the pilot organizations. I do take great exception to somebody coming up here and testifying that this will destroy a group when it won't. In fact, this bill right here gives legitimacy to any group and they can survive. Gives them a grandfather clause in here of 1994 to qualify. Yes, the standards are going up. The standards should go up. Antitrust is a red herring as far as changing any litigation. I doubt if it would matter. If you were wronged in the past, I would think the courts would give you some sort of retribution if you were wronged. I'm not an attorney, but I'm not sure that any change in legislation would change that. Again, I do say this bill gives legitimacy what's going on in your backyard right now. The two major associations, Southeast, Southwest Alaska Pilots Associations, have been the safety net under the State Pilotage Act for 20 years. It's time the state finished its regulatory process and wrote the Pilotage Act that will protect the state waters and ensure that there's pilots out there that are qualified and they're on there a year round. All day and all night long. Thank you. Any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, Dale. Representative Parnell, next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it too simple a question to ask if you could provide us with existing standards, proposed standards, and standards of the other organizations that seem to be lower?
That would be very easy to provide.
Possible?
Yes, that would be very easy to provide.
That would be good to review.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
We next have C.L. Cloudy, something like that.
No, I just signed my name, but I didn't come to testify.
Okay, thank you.
I'm counsel for Southeast Pilots. I'm serving today.
Great, thanks for your attendance. Bob Arks.